Good afternoon. Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Have you noticed? Concussions have suddenly become a big deal, especially in athletics. Why is this increased interest occurring, and what does it mean, especially for athletes, parents, and coaches? My guest today is Lynn Young. Lynn has got a National Athletic Trainer certification. She works for Orthopedic Physicians Anchorage, and she's also a member of the Alaska School Activities Association Sports Medicine Advisory Committee. She's been doing a yeoman's job of going around helping everybody understand the new return to play recommendations and educating us all about concussions. That's our topic today, concussions, and also we'll be getting into the return to play recommendations, especially now that football season is over and the hockey season is coming around. We got to educate a whole group of coaches and parents again, it sounds like, Lynn.
Yes, sir. Let the education begin.
If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So why is this interest suddenly coming about in concussions? And I guess I should ask, am I wrong? Or is this rather a sudden change, meaning in the last couple of years it's gotten a lot more attention?
No, you're absolutely correct. It has had a great degree of interest, and that's due to the fact that research has shown that there's a lot of long-term problems associated with these relatively mild episodes of concussed athletes. And decades later, we're finding out that if they were treated properly, we may be able to minimize them. Also, unfortunately, there's a few deaths happening in our high school athletics, yearly due to the improper return and the improper management of these concussions.
So that's what we're going to get into, is the management of these things. But in addition, what you're saying is, you know, we've really known that concussions have been a part, particularly of athletics, for a long, long, long time. But we've never drawn the conclusion that there may be long-term sequelae. And that's, I guess, the way I think of what's changed.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And the second impact idea is also something that's beginning to be a little bit better understood, or at least we're trying to get the word out about that.
Correct. And second impact syndrome is basically another episode of a concussion before the first concussion has completely healed, has devastating effects. Most of the time, 50% of these people end up dying. The other 50% have major disabilities. In fact, breathing tubes, can't walk, etc. So second impact is preventable. And it's just not returning these people to play. And most of them happen to our athletes that are under 18. I think there's only been one or two documented cases of possibly 20 or 21, but majority are 18 and under.
Is there a reason that we know? I mean, we know that the nervous system of adolescents are still growing. They're still maturing, especially the frontal lobes in particular. Is that the reason for that, or is it better care of older athletes or something else?
I know that absolutely the frontal lobe still develops up until about the age of 25, and that's the main indicator right now. And of course, I think that there's a large percentage of under 18 that participate in recreational and, you know, the school age sports. Whereas as we get older, you know, some go on to play professional in college, and then we kind of tend to be just the weekend warriors.
So it seems like, in particularly in football and hockey, is where we have come to realize there's some long-term sequelae. Why was it not noticed before?
I think in everything, medical diagnostic tests and studies have improved. So I think that now when those baby boomers, et cetera, are getting to that age, our medical abilities are able to figure out what's going on. And also, what you had said, football absolutely is the number one sport of our concussed athletes, but then closely followed by girls' soccer, boys' soccer, girls' basketball, and then boys' basketball. Hockey, I imagine, would be probably number two. However, outside sports, outside of the Alaska, does not have that much data on ice hockey.
And there's probably a lot more kids playing women's soccer than hockey, I'm guessing. I don't want to say something unclear, and football is a big one. So it sounds like it's, to a large degree, higher impact sports. But when you mention girls soccer, I don't think about that. And I'm gonna guess, and I'm guessing. I always want you to set me wrong that it's not the ball hitting the head that's the problem. Or is it?
Well, we're still researching that. There's research on the repeated trauma of heading the ball. Right. How many is correct before it possibly could cause subconcussive forces to cause neurological damages, but also two people going up for a ball, missing the ball, hitting heads or hitting bodies, causing a jolt of the brain can cause a concussion as well.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Running into the goalpost, things of that nature.
Yeah. Because I had four daughters that played soccer recently, I got questioned about that a lot. And I remember looking in the Academy of Pediatrics literature a couple of years ago, and there was not any clear recommendations that headers were a problem. Has that changed?
I don't think any medical group has stood up and found anything conclusive as of right now. Speculation of the headers of starting too young. They typically don't do that. I know that there is some research on progressing towards kind of like a pitch count for our batters, as far as only so many headers at practice or a game for 8 and under and then 10 and under, or some even say under 11 shouldn't be doing headers. And so we really don't have a clear, concise answer for that yet.
Yeah. All right, so let's back up. I got too wild and crazy there for free thinking. What is a concussion? Let's define our terms, which we should have done right at the beginning.
Whenever I'm asked that, I always say it's a brain injury, which I can get a lot of fierce looks from parents when I say that. But basically, if you look at the actual medical diagnosis, it's a complex pathophysical process affecting the brain induced by trauma. It's any jolt. It could be caused by the head hitting a force, another helmet, the ground, a goalpost. It could also be caused by a whiplash injury. A lot of times people just hit chest to chest and the head will swing forward or backwards, causing that brain to move and hit the skull.
So it's not just athletes either. We focused on that, and we may spend a lot of time, but I think it's reasonable to say that's not the whole story.
That's correct. A number of military personnel are getting what's called a TBI, traumatic brain injury, which is a concussion. Our recreational athletes on four-wheelers fall, even with helmets. Our kids on bikes fall. Car accidents. So it's widespread.
Yep, and you only have one noggin, so you got to kind of protect it. And bicycling is I'm amazed at how many serious injuries I see to people on bicycles. And, I think we are seeing more kids wearing helmets, but not enough.
Correct. And then you see the mom and dad without a helmet, followed by the kids with the helmet. So I think it's lead by example.
Years ago in my office, I had a father come in with her son. The two of them were bicycling to the office, and Dad was a rather experienced bicyclist. I can't remember how competitive he was, but he did do some competitive stuff. So this is a guy who knows what he's doing. He had a helmet on, an older-style helmet, but on the way there, he hit some gravel or something. I don't remember specifically, and he fell. And the point I'm trying to make is his helmet broke. So here's a guy who's just riding to our place, and he knows what he's doing, and may have saved his life. And so for a long time, we had the helmet in our waiting room. I asked him if we could have a broken helmet, which trying to encourage people to understand that, although it helps to know the whole story, because, biking
is one of the leading causes, too.
Is it?
Absolutely.
A non-athletic kind of, I guess in a sense there's some athletic to it. So What's happening then? I mean, I get the feeling from what you're telling me is it doesn't take a heck of a lot of trauma to cause what's called a concussion. And for many people out there, they're still going to think, you have to have lost consciousness and so forth. So let's be a little bit more specific about how we're going to define it.
And I'm glad you brought up the loss of consciousness. Research has recently said that less than 10% of people actually do lose consciousness. So that's part of that old school mentality that we're trying to change, that they don't have to black out. They don't have to see stars. There's also something called, and I'm kind of going on a different tangent, but it's called a Monday morning concussion. An athlete can participate Friday or Saturday and seem to be okay, but then a couple days later, they start to get some of the signs and symptoms of a concussion with the headaches or the dizziness or the forgetfulness. So we're finding that it's not sometimes one episode, one aha hit that we all watch on football and get excited about. Concussions are any problem to the brain when it actually ricochets on the skull. A lot of times, too, with the helmets, you brought up a good point on the cracked helmets. There is problem with people thinking that they're protected by helmet. There's some companies that say, buy this $500 helmet because it will prevent concussions. There is nothing that will prevent concussions, unfortunately. We're not there yet. The brain, to do a little anatomy, is located in some fluid. And so until we find something that actually screws the brain in place, there's always the problem of it jiggling in the brain. And so what is enough force to cause damage to it? We don't know yet. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of studies on what part of the head gets hit. Does that cause somebody to be more susceptible? Again, we're not there, but we're trying.
Yeah, so helmets, the way I think of it, or maybe it was you that, because you gave a lecture in our office about this, is that helmets can prevent skull fractures, but they don't prevent concussions, which is not what most of us think.
That's true. You know, you don't want to not have a good helmet because it does decrease the risk of skull fractures and structural components. Mm-hmm. But a concussion, if you think of a computer, you have the structural body of the computer and then you have the software. That's similar to what a concussion is, to use that kind of analogy. It's the software. Something's not going right in the brain. And so certainly headgear helmets will decrease that skull fractures, but it won't prevent concussions.
Mm-hmm. So some of the injury, I guess, because we're now thinking of concussions as not just loss of consciousness, may be very minute structural changes in the brain and the way the physiology, the neurotransmitters and so forth are working, so that it doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily a hard hit. It could be some shearing forces where the brain is moving, again, it's kind of a gelatinous mass inside this hard skull, that there could be some kind of, I guess the word is shearing forces, that are causing some problems. Or there's injury to the surface of the brain, like a contusion or actually bleeding could occur and so forth. So there's quite a bit of variability in the injuries that could possibly be sustained.
Absolutely. And what somebody could take a certain force hit may cause a concussion in that individual, but not necessarily another one. And, you know, different positions on sports get the repeated blows. And how many of those repeated blows can cause these subconcussive forces go on to cause problems down the road or go on to cause a concussion?
Let me take a second to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. We're originating from KSKA in Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments about concussions, and we're going to get into some of the recommendations for follow-up as we kind of ferret out the idea of concussions a little bit more, you can reach us locally at 550-8433 for toll-free listeners, 1-888-353-5752. And then you can email during the next 45 minutes or so to line1@alaskapublic.org. So what kind of symptoms, as well as what kind of injuries? I still am kind of envision that maybe listeners are a little bit confused that all or any injury to the head could cause the problem. What kind of injuries would make you worried, and then what kind of symptoms?
Okay. Some of the signs and symptoms would be one of the most common ones is a headache. You get a headache, and typically it's not localized to where the object hit the head. It's diffuse. It's usually in that frontal lobe area, but it can be any posterior, etc. Nausea, dizziness, sometimes vomiting, a dazed look. One of the biggest red flags I get, and no other injury has this, but the athlete or the individual will say, I feel like I'm in a fog. And the fact that they just say that is a huge indicator. Sometimes light or noise sensitivity that will hurt their eyes or cause them more headache, a ringing in the ears, confused, slower to respond. They may respond correctly, but it takes them longer than normal. One of the classic textbook ones is irritable, but I kind of throw that one out because typically my athletes are always irritable when I'm holding them out to assess them. So that one's kind of a hard. But certainly any changes in personality, coordination, balance is a huge one.
How about the timing of these things? Are they mostly immediate or can they be delayed? You've already kind of commented about the Monday morning situation, suggesting that at times it can be a little delayed. Are the majority of these things happening fairly quickly after the injury?
Mm-hmm. Majority are. Of course, the easier ones to diagnose and to treat are the ones where they sustain a hit or they fall and they come back and you can see them kind of stumbling to the sideline. They complain of the headache, the dizziness, and those are the typical ones. However, the scary ones are the ones where they sustain a hit and the athlete comes to you after the game or after a few plays and says, gosh, I've had this headache after a certain fall or a hit and I still can't shake it. And so we're finding a number of those, unfortunately, are happening, but that's due to the lack of education. We need to really educate people to come forward with those signs and symptoms earlier.
I would think that another problem is a lot of athletes not only are irritable if they have to talk to you, but they don't want to be talking to you.
Oh, absolutely.
And they don't want to be saying that there's anything wrong. So part of the education is making the athlete himself aware of the potential hazards of this problem.
Not only the athlete, but we have to hold teammates accountable too, as well as the coaching staff, because a lot of the investigation of some of these deaths that have happened in the lower 48, of these kids that have received second impact that have died, it's been reported that they've told mom or dad or they told a teammate, gosh, I was still having a headache. Never told a medical professional or a coach, and so these teammates need to also. And part of that can be alleviated by having a meeting preseason and sitting down with parents and the players and the coaches and saying, here's why we need to take concussions seriously. Here's what we're going to do about them. Here's how we're going to treat this so it clears completely and we can return your son or daughter to play. And, of course, as you mentioned, you know, old school mentality too. Oh, I just got the bell rung out of me, or I had three concussions and I'm okay. Well, are you okay? Kind of a thing. and those things we have to teach and to re-educate.
What are the long-term consequences that we're beginning to recognize?
Long-term are memory problems, balance problems. There is something recently that has been brought to the attention of called a CTE, a chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that people might have heard with the recent death of Junior Seau. This can only be diagnosed after a person dies, and they do some autopsies on the brain, and they're finding this tau protein. And that is definitely problematic, and some of those problems are poor decisions in life, depression, suicides, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And is it true that some of the Parkinson-like things, I mean, I think of Muhammad Ali as a person who was, you know, one of the epitomes of health, and yet I don't recall him. I grew up watching him box, getting tagged very often, but he certainly has got a Parkinson's-like illness, it seems like to me. And is that been pretty well established that is a potential consequence of these head injuries as well, or not sure yet?
They're not sure. They're doing research on that. Certainly boxing, the whole goal of that sport is to give them a concussion, basically, to cause them to get knocked out. But, you know, there is some correlation between him and his Parkinson's. There's also some correlation between Alzheimer's patients. But, you know, with these autopsies on the brains, they're seeing the markings of this tau protein is different. Mm-hmm. So they know this is a separate entity. They're also recently doing some research on Lou Gehrig disease, and there's a correlation on that as well. So again, we know enough to learn more.
Let's discuss the second impact syndrome just a little bit more, since it's such a significant issue. You want to define that once again for us, and you mentioned there's a certain age group where it's a little, seems like it's more common.
Certainly. Second impact syndrome is basically the athlete sustaining a second concussion before the first one has completely resolved or healed. Usually that second injury or that second impact is relatively minor. It's not a major hit or a major concussive episode. It could be just, you know, swinging the head around for a whiplash type of an injury. It's a massive, uncontrollable cerebral edema. Usually it's a sudden onset. Seconds to minutes, the athlete will typically be able to kind of stagger to the sideline to where their signs and symptoms will deteriorate fast. There's a 50% mortality rate with this. We know that most of the cases have been under 18, with one or two documented of, I believe, 21. It is extremely preventable, as I mentioned. It's just we can't return these kids or these individuals before the brain is healed.
I'm going to take a second to just help people understand what this cerebral edema means and why it is so dangerous. Your brain is really a very soft, gelatinous organ that's sitting inside this solid skull. So with injury, there is usually swelling, and we might at times call that edema. So there's sudden massive swelling of the brain, and it's in an area where it can't expand very well. And as a consequence, there's increased pressure intracranially inside the brain, in the head, as you said, in the brain. And with that comes a lack of blood supply to the brain, and so suddenly you got big problems, and that's why this is so catastrophic. And what you're saying is this is leading to why these return to play recommendations have gotten much more stringent, I'm guessing, is because these happen, as you said, this second impact syndrome in people who have not fully recovered from the first concussion. So how do we know you've recovered from the first concussion?
And that's the billion-dollar question, unfortunately. I wish there was one diagnostic test that we could, you know. The joke is looking in their pupil and finding that they're okay, which unfortunately we're not there yet. You know, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. Old school, 10, 15 years ago, was should a person get a concussion, we were going to wait till they had no symptoms. And then 7 to 10 days later, when they had no symptoms, we were throwing them back into the game. And we know that we're not testing the brain. We're not exercising it. So the current guidelines are, after a thorough eval, if a student athlete has received a concussion, or anybody for that matter, we are immediately removing them from play. We're taking them out of their contest, and we're evaluating them. Even if they evaluate good, we're still not returning them back to play. We're waiting 24 hours for all their signs and symptoms to be gone. And after 24 hours of no signs and symptoms, we're starting this internationally recognized return to play protocol. There's 6 steps, and basically what we're doing is we're exercising the brain. The first step is light exercise. I usually put an athlete on a stationary bike for about 10 minutes, having their blood pressure or their pulse, about 100 beats per minute. Once that 10 minutes is over, we go ahead and do an eval. Should no signs and symptoms reappear in another 24 hours, then we go to step 2. And it just increases the exercise, again, looking to see if that increase has caused a return. Once they get through that and they're medically cleared, then we'll go ahead and let them go back to competition. So at a minimal, an athlete could return in about a week.
Mm-hmm. So the point here is it is important to really exercise the brain to see if it's really working appropriately before you move to the next step. And then when it's really clear that thinking, memory, judgment, not getting worse with exercise, all of that is clear, then it is felt to be safe, and the likelihood of the second impact syndrome is much, much, much less likely.
And that's absolutely correct. Again, we're not guaranteeing. Mm-hmm. We're putting a lot of ownership on the athlete as well, and saying if any return of these signs and symptoms, you need to let us know if we can't see them on our own. And, you know, it kind of makes sense that if you think of somebody with a sprained ankle, we're not just waiting for the swelling to go down and throwing them back into a contest. We're going to let them jump on it. We're going to let them jog in some controlled exercises before we throw them back on a basketball court or have them hike up a mountain, et cetera. So we need to exercise that brain as well, which also leads to another component of this return to play that a lot of people forget is the academic portion. Not only does a brain participate in athletics, but it's a source of reading and things of that nature. So sometimes we need to adjust their schoolwork. The part that usually gets the frown from my athletes is no video games and no texting as well until the brain, is responding well.
And the idea there?
The brain has to work to text and to play these games. And so the more that we poke at it or we ask it to work, the longer these signs and symptoms may last.
Lynn, do we have, since these are pretty standard recommendations that the Alaska's using and professional athletes are using these things, do we know that period of rest is an important part of this process? Do we know that that helps healing, or do we know that this is something that seems to correlate well with a less likelihood of something like a second impact syndrome?
I would probably lean towards the less likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the more that we challenge the brain, even just sending kids back to school when they're still mm-hmm. symptomatic, sometimes can prolong the symptoms and mm-hmm. make it more than 2 or 3 weeks and possibly cause them to go into a post-concussion syndrome. But again, we treat them as individuals. Every person is different in how they respond.
How common is the second impact syndrome? Is this a relatively uncommon, rare, but tragic, and we hear about it in the national media very quickly when it happens, or is it happening pretty significantly?
Oh, man, that's a great question.
Don't know.
We just don't know.
Yeah.
Thankfully, there's probably 5 or 6 only, and I say only, deaths a year. So at that point, it's not hugely widespread. However, if that's somebody that's close to you, obviously very important. But I don't think we have an exact number or percentage of that.
And because I was trained as an epidemiologist, I think do we know the age group that it happens is? Is it male or female, or is it associated more with any sports?
That's a great question. And typically, research has showed, I believe, is strictly male right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's based on men or male sport or athletes basically are in those contact collision sports. Does not mean women or females are immune to it as well. And hopefully we never see any more deaths on this. But I think it's probably only a matter of time till it shows up.
How big a problem are these concussive injuries then? I mean, do we have a fairly good indication of, you know, how many times in a typical high school football season there are going to be concussive injuries? And you've already mentioned some of the sports where we see it more often.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, estimates that between 1.6 and 3.8 million concussions are in ERs and physician offices a year. And these are both recreational athletes and the typical school-age athlete. I think that's a little bit low because there's a lot of time that we treat them at the high school athletic trainers or school nurses, and they don't go see an ER. So that's quite a bit. I mean, there's a lot. I don't know the certain percentage. I know here through our football season at a number of the high schools with an 8-week season, not uncommon for there to be 10 to 11 concussions on CJV and varsity collectively.
Let's go ahead and take our halfway break at this point. Let me remind listeners that we're talking about concussions, and we've gotten into a little bit of the new return to play recommendations that are being recommended both nationally and with professional as well as high school sports. I'm going to ferret those out a little bit more in the next 20 or 30 minutes. But let me remind you, if you've got questions or comments about the program today, and particularly about concussions, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be taking just a very brief break, and then we'll rejoin our guest, Lynn Young. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
KSKA is listener-supported radio. Hello, I'm Steve Heimel, host of Talk of Alaska, and we're inviting you to call right now, 550-8484, and pledge your financial support to keep local and statewide news and information programs going strong on FM 91.1. Toll free, the number is 800-478-5256. 91.1 FM is where to tune for local, statewide, and national news and information. Each Monday, you tune into your health with KSKA's locally produced program, Line 1, Your Health Connection, with Dr. Thad Woodard. The call-in invites you to talk to experts in the health field on issues that affect your health and your family's well-being. Dr. Woodard keeps you connected with your community and offers insight and information on issues that matter to you. Call in with your pledge of support, 550-8484, or 800-478-5256. KSKA, the Alaska Public Radio Network, NPR, and the BBC all work together to provide the best news and information public service on radio today. You rely on the Alaska Public Radio Network, and KSKA relies on you and your financial support to keep this public service healthy and vital. In Anchorage, call 550-8484, toll-free 800-478-5256. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is Lynn Young. Lynn is a nationally certified athletic trainer. She's working full-time with Orthopedic Physicians Anchorage, and she's also spending a lot of time educating the public and athletes and coaches and about concussions and new recommendations on return to play and why those recommendations are based in some good science. If you've got questions or comments, our email address during the next 30 minutes or so is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evening, you're listening to a rebroadcast and we won't be available. That also reminds me, at any time, you can go to alaskapublic.org and listen to these podcasts. They are archived, and they're available for you to listen to. You can recommend a coach or a parent or anyone to go and come back later and listen to the program, particularly if you've got some athletes involved and you want to know more about it. I think this would be a good way to get them to listen. So you go to alaskapublic.org. At the Line 1 link, you'll also find several very reliable links to national information and a very good talk from a neuropsychologist about the long-term sequelae that they are seeing with concussions. What about prevention, Lynn? You know, we've ferreted out the idea that helmets are not a preventative mechanism for concussion. What can we do to prevent concussions?
There's not one set thing to prevent concussions, again, because the brain is not secured and there can be wiggle room. Probably the biggest preventative measure is education, and that would be educating people on what to look for so we don't return these people back to an unsafe environment, so we do completely rest it. Because we know that majority of concussions will heal and they will be okay, the individual. However, it's the certain percentage that goes and returns to an unsafe environment that has the problems.
Okay. Angie, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Oops. I think she may have dropped off. Let's go ahead and take Mark. Mark, you're on line one.
Thank you. I was in New York this summer, and they just passed a state regulation that all schools that have contact sports, the students must take a pre-concussion test before they play a contact sport. So then if they do have an injury, that they have something to measure that against.
Right.
And I don't know if we have that in Alaska, but as a school psychologist, I can tell you that I think that would be a very important step to take. And thank you.
Yeah, let's ask Lynn about that.
Hi, Mark. Thank you. Absolutely. In Anchorage, the Anchorage School District has mandated that the students do take a neurocognitive test, a baseline test, which is called the IMPACT. There are a variety of different ones, but that's the one that they decided to use. It's about a 20-minute computer online test that tests speed, memory, things of that nature. Should a individual get a concussion, it is definitely utilized as a tool to take that as a repeat. And that brings a great point that the neurocognitive test is one tool that we use to evaluate for a safe return. Certainly, if we do have that baseline and it comes back to normative findings, we're also going to test our physical signs and symptoms as well as a balance component. Neurocognitively, they could be okay. Physical signs and symptoms are okay, but their balance could be off. There's also some baseline tests that you can use in store balance, because we know that some people have better balance than others. But absolutely, I just want you to know Anchorage School District does require that. They require it once in middle school and once in high school. Me as a parent, I would definitely do that, but I would do it yearly, because in my opinion, a freshman, boy or girl, neurocognitively, mentally, is not probably the same as if they were a senior. But right now, the guidelines are once during the senior, once during the middle school.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And the purpose for this, again, is to have another way to assess the whether or not neurologic dysfunction has occurred after a head injury.
Absolutely. And what people used to do prior to that also is, and this brings a different point that needs to be addressed, is usually when you went to the ER, you had a CT scan done immediately. And we're finding that what that does is it shows structural problems. And again, we know that concussions are not structural, so we're leading away from that. But this neurocognitive baseline, it just basically shows that, yes, in a finer data, that that person has gone back to where they were before.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the questions and techniques and instruments that are being used to assess these finer cognitive functions that we're using to make these judgments on?
Different forms of these neurocognitives. The impact test, which we're using here. The one that I really utilize a lot is called a SCAT-2, S-C-A-T-2, and you can Google that. There's no copyright problems. They want you to download that. There's even free apps that you can put on your phone. And basically what that does is it requires a couple components. One is a symptom checklist. You're asking this individual certain signs and symptoms that they are experiencing, headaches, dizzy, nausea. It also has a portion that we're asking memory, both retrograde and anterior grade, which is retrograde is asking important information that happened prior to the concussive event. What happened? Where were you? What is your birthday, et cetera? I don't like the birthday one because I have hundreds of athletes and can never tell what their birthdays are. But what was the score, et cetera? Who did you play last week? Anterior grade is things that happen after the concussive event. Usually it's a three-word recall. Girl, car, red. And then we'll ask them to repeat that in 5 or 10 minutes. And we're trying to see if their brain can hold on to that information and dictate it. Other things that we use are spelling words backwards. How do you spell Monday backwards? Or digit span. I'll say 519, and I'll ask an individual to tell me that backwards, 915. Also on a good eval would be the balance component, standing on one leg, closing your eyes, touching your finger to your nose, and we're checking to see how many mistakes that they make. Hands go off their hips, their foot touches down, etc. So we have the three components. We have a neurocog, we have physical signs and symptoms, we're asking them to help us, and then we also have the balance component.
And there are a lot of the reason you'd like to have one before any injury is to compare with is there's a lot of differences between individuals. So, you know, two individuals that neither one of them have had a problem might be very different on that testing, I'm guessing. And certainly age has a factor from a balance standpoint and a memory standpoint.
Absolutely. And what happens if you don't have a baseline for whatever reason? Do you not use these? Well, we can do one of these tests and then just track them a couple days because we have that return to play protocol. Mm-hmm. So we're not putting these people back to play right away. Also,
so you can see if that gets better over time.
Absolutely. And also we're doing a history of that individual because, again, it's an individual. It's not a set scale. But if we find that this is a straight A student as opposed to a straight C student, obviously we would expect their neurocognitive scores to be a little bit higher than the C. And then also, you know, are they medicated? Do they, you know, need medication? Are they on that? Are they not on that?
Are all schools in Alaska supposed to be using this now?
No, and it's not a mandated requirement. I know some of the other school districts recommend it. I know some of them in Fairbanks, because I know the athletic trainers that work up there, are doing a SCAT-2 as the baseline. And so they do that test and they put that in the individual file. The best concussion management is to have some kind of baseline with whatever you choose.
How is this kind of, you know, pre-testing, given some baseline, compare with what professional athletes are doing. And I'm sure colleges are in between, but I'm assuming that they're probably up there more like the college. Are we all doing the same thing?
Yes. Colleges are doing a lot of the impact or the SCAT 2. NFL is doing a lot of those pre-baselines. Even NASCAR is doing that as well. Just recently, Dale Earnhardt Jr. was in the news that he had suffered a second concussion, and they were going to test his brain in an exercise before returning him back to the car. So across the board, professional, college, high school, we're all learning that that's the best to do.
Okay. We have another caller. Is it Michael or Michelle?
Michelle,
what can we do for you?
Yeah, good afternoon, and thanks for the very nice show. Very nice. Okay, quick questions. I am a senior citizen, and I took a fall with my bike. I had a whiplash, flew over the handle, and knocked the ground quite hard, very hard. Shall I expect anything later on in life, or could Alzheimer's set in sooner? I mean, it was quite a pounding. Okay. The CAT scan didn't reveal anything at all, but I still have the neck muscle, of course, which are hurting. But that's what it is.
All right. Let's see if Lynn wants to ask you any other questions. I know what you're asking her. Let's see if she wants to know anything else.
Well, I'm sorry for your fall, first of all. I'm glad that you're able to call in and listen. It would be, do you still have any of the symptoms? Do you feel like you're going to throw up or nausea or dizzy?
No. That was the first week only, the first 10 days. That's it.
Okay. And so now you feel completely fine?
Except for the neck muscle. The rotation of my head, it's limited. The flexibility, it's still limited. I still have some trigger point way up on both sides of my head, which are very, very sensitive, and I got headaches sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And that would explain a lot of that as well. I would say, unfortunately, we don't know if that's going to cause long-term problems. Certainly, you're on the right road to recovery, that you're feeling better, and you don't have any of the initial concussive symptoms now. Were you wearing a helmet?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Good job.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
Well, wonderful. And continue to wear a helmet. But I would say, work on those neck muscles. And once you feel completely fine, you have great range of motion, I would say that it's probably safe to go on to a controlled walk. And then after you exercise a little bit, if you have no headache or none of those signs and symptoms, you can progress a little bit more aggressively. But I would give it some time.
About cross-country skiing?
I would actually go on a walk on stationary ground with somebody first, and then make sure that you don't have a headache or get nausea or dizzy, and then progress from there. I wouldn't go right on to cross-country skis. I would fall, but maybe you're better than me.
No. Okay, I'm past that stage. Anyway, it's been a month now, and I'm past the stage you are describing, so
I think you're probably okay.
Did you have any problems with thinking or memory that you recall, or just feel foggy or not as clear as you thought you should have been, or not notice anything like that?
Well, when you are 70 years old, you've got all what you describe anyhow. So, no more than usual. Mm-hmm. I just flew off. I didn't know because I pass out at the whiplash, and I pass out. So I woke up landing, kissing the ground.
All right. Yeah, that's, I guess, my understandings is we don't understand all the factors that lead to the long-term sequelae. We don't know if it's multiple small hits, one or two big hits of the wrong type. It's just we don't have that information yet. I think it's certainly reassuring that you're back to normal for 70. So keep it up.
Well, of course, that's why I want to get ready for skiing.
Yeah. If let me play the devil's advocate. Let's say we start doing a little bit more vigorous exercise and headache recurs during that you never had before. Would that be bothersome? To Lynn, I'm asking you.
Oh, yes. If you do start to do some rigorous activity and you get a return of headache, et cetera, you should stop, and I would see your local healthcare provider at that point.
Okay. Are you suggesting, for example, any therapy like massage or acupuncture? I had some already, but do you think that's a good venue?
Absolutely. For those tight neck muscles, I would definitely say some warm therapy and some range of motion would be beneficial.
Yeah. Are you for the heating pad also? They got those kind of cushion heating pad wrapping up around your neck. Are you for that too?
Oh, absolutely. Especially since it's been a month, the nice heating pad, as long as you don't burn yourself, make sure that you don't put it too hot, will definitely warm it up. Or a nice hot shower. When you're in the shower, let the warm water hit those neck muscles.
Yeah. Hey, what do you think of those patches? It's some patches to release some medication over the counter you can buy. What do you think of those patches?
I'm familiar with some of the brands. There's a variety, so I wouldn't be able to tell you completely what I think of that. But some of the just heat, I know, has been beneficial to some of the larger muscle masses.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Be careful
Bye-bye.
Out there.
Oh, well, that's life.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ann, what can we do for you?
Hi, I'm not an athlete, but I did ride on the back seat of a snow machine, and I had a helmet on, but I felt I had brain bounce. Is there such a thing? Am I making this up, or?
What do you mean by what happened? What symptoms did you have?
Well, you go over, like, a little rough terrain, and then you kind of bounce up, and then I just felt that my brain was hitting my skull.
Okay, but you had no other problems, not a lot of headache, not a lot of nausea, memory problems, anything like that?
Certainly those type of maneuvers could cause concussions, but, you know, the concussion awareness is extremely important, but by no means just, you know, everything does not cause a concussion. Possibly down the road, you know, could we do some studies of subconcussive forces of, you know, the chronic snow machiners that could lead to something? Absolutely. But I would say, you know, your whole body does take a toll when you go snow machining on the terrain over here. And so if you did not have any of those signs and symptoms afterwards, I would be aware and I would be cognitive of it, but not too concerned.
So that is a possibility.
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What are coaches being educated about this? And you've mentioned that many schools are having trainers or trying to get trainers. And then are there several questions here? What's the rapid tests on the sideline to get some idea about objective evidence that maybe a concussion has happened?
Well, there's a couple questions there.
There was.
Right now what we're doing is we're recommending that all coaches at the high school and junior high level take a 20-minute online CDC Heads Up Concussion in Sports course. It's done by a certified athletic trainer. It's really good information, and it gives you basically signs and symptoms to look for, protocol, and also the return to play steps. And so that's part of our coaches' education. I know the coaches that we work with, we before the season even starts, sit down with them, and we talk about concussions, what we're going to do, how we're going to manage them, et cetera, so everybody's on the same page. And then also, once the team is established, we do a mandatory parent, athlete, coach meeting to where the schools that I work with, I'll talk to them and give them just signs and symptoms and not scare them, but give them the reality of what could happen if they return to play too soon. As far as a rapid test to know if a kid or an athlete does have a concussion, basically, if there is not a healthcare provider, not a school nurse, not an athletic trainer or doctor on the sideline, and you, the coach, are there, or the parent, and an athlete comes to the sideline and says, man, I got a headache, I don't feel good, I'm dizzy, state law says that person is removed from play for the rest of that day until they're evaluated. So we're going to remove them from play and then ask them baseline questions. There are a lot of great websites out there that will give you signs and symptoms of a concussion. I think that they're on your Line 1 website as far as the CDC has free materials, facts about concussions, checklists to ask the individual, certainly testing their balance. If you see deterioration of these signs and symptoms, definitely that would warrant getting them to the emergency room or a healthcare provider.
Let me remind listeners again, we're in our last, maybe 7 or 8 minutes. If you've got questions or comments about concussions, this is a good time to have them ask, and hopefully we can answer them for you. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, 550-8433. And don't forget, you can go back to alaskapublic.org, look for the Line 1 link, and listen to this program anytime that you would like, or recommend to others listen to it. Let's do this, Len. Let's go over the return to play things one more time, and so that parents and listeners can hear those recommendations. They're definitely different than most of us have experienced. It's new. It's a big change, and it's very difficult to get the word out to everybody. So I want to make sure we get that out as best we can today.
Okay. And the current return to play protocol is an international approved protocol. It's also endorsed by the National Federation of High School Sports, and now has been adopted by the state of Alaska as well. Basically, what it is, it begins when our individual is asymptomatic, has no signs and symptoms, for a minimum of 24 hours. Once that happens, they can start something low impact, walking, stationary bike, something that's very low impact for about 10 or 15 minutes. Each step is 24 hours, so following that first step, if there's no return of signs and symptoms, they can progress to step two. Step two would be a moderate aerobic activity, some jogging, skating, some running, and some progressive strength training, push-ups, sit-ups, those types of activities. Again, we're going to wait 24 hours. Should no signs and symptoms return, we'll go to the next step. That's where they can begin non-contact skills specific to the drill. For a basketball player, they can start dribbling. They can start fielding in a baseball. They could start some running routes in a football, etc. Again, 24 hours pass, no return of signs and symptoms. They can go to a full contact practice setting. Once that happens and they have no return of signs and symptoms, the next step would be that they can actually go to their full competition. Now, this is supervised as well. And the individual and all participants around them need to know that while they're doing one of these steps, if they have any return signs and symptoms, they're running a route and, gosh, I'm getting a headache or I'm starting to feel dizzy, they immediately need to notify the adult that's in charge and stop that activity. Should they have return of signs and symptoms at any step along the way, then we're going to wait 24 hours for their signs and symptoms to decrease, and then we're going to go to the step prior to them getting those signs and symptoms. I know that this sounds really confusing and crazy, but all this is on the ASAA website as well, on the return to play protocol. It's also incorporated into the Anchorage School District return to play form following a concussion. That way providers, when they sign off on whether a student athlete can return to play, they see that return to play protocol because it is relatively new.
We had an email ask how many concussions are too many. I notice in the professional football ranks, at least, that after a couple or three or four or something, many professional athletes or many quarterbacks in particular are retiring from the game. Is there a absolute line in the sand on this?
There's not a magical number. It used to be two or three in a season would disqualify. Again, a lot of factors go into play. What is the age? What is the type of sport? So relatively, no. It's individualized, and we just have to take it case by case.
Okay. Another caller. Let's take Frank. Frank, what can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a brain cancer survivor several times, and I was hired out of a head injury support group, and I facilitate that group. It meets twice a month at Access Alaska, and we have a meeting tomorrow night at 6 p.m.
You got a phone number, a contact, or an email for Access Alaska?
You can check it out at, you can get 907-263-1900 here in Anchorage.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a good day. So in these return to play, you've got to be asymptomatic for 24 hours. And it's not hard for me to imagine, since I've seen kids have headaches with exercise or with daily for a week after a concussion. So we can't even get started on the progression until you're asymptomatic. I wanted to make that clear. And so the minimum, it looks like to me, is maybe 5 or 6 days after a concussion before we're really back to full activity is the current recommendation.
Minimum 6 to 7, correct.
6 to 7. Mm-hmm. I miscalculated my days there. I'd heard that before, but I didn't add it up as quickly. So that must get some resistance.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Nobody wants to hear that they're going to miss the state championship, et cetera,
right,
if it happens the day before. And again, because of the old school mentality,
right.
There was a widely used scale that says signs and symptoms resolve in 15 minutes. They can go back to play. 10, 15 years ago, I would do that as well. But now studies have shown that it's more dangerous. So I think to alleviate that, that's why there's so much attention and importance on the meeting prior to the season. Everybody's on the same page. We know why we're doing this. We know what to expect. But certainly, Johnny feels fine. Why can't he play? Well, we don't know what's going to cause that brain to get hurt again.
Okay. We probably only have time for one more question, and then I want to make sure you just summarize very succinctly what we want listeners to remember from this. But I guess the question keeps coming up in many people's minds, certainly in mine, is what do we know about these long-term sequelae? If Parkinson's like problems, if Lou Gehrig's disease, if these tau proteins are happening, what do we know about the forces required to do that? I have heard that running backs in football have a greater risk than linemen. Linemen are beating their head against each other every day, many times during the day, but the running back may only have one or two really hard hits a game or something. Where do we stand in being able to interpret the risk factors for the long term?
But there's so many studies going on. They're doing sensors in the helmet, and we know that high school can have over 100 G-forces. We know that jet pilots, typically it's an 8 or 9, but that's a sustained G-force. I understand
right.
that. But we know some of the high school football players are getting forces that are over 100 Gs. We do know that linemen get the most hits. They might not be those concussive forces
right.
which mm-hmm. causes somebody to fall down, but certainly the repeated. So right now the current line is studies on those one-time forces that cause concussions and the subconcussive forces that go on over a period of time, which possibly can cause long-term problems. Both of them we're finding can.
All right, our last minute. I've gotten in the habit of wanting to ask our guests to tell us, what do we want to learn? What do we want to try to remember from this program?
Basically that we just need to treat concussions as conservatively as possible. You have one brain. Certainly we need to protect that. And if in doubt, sit them out. That's what I tell everybody. If we're not sure, we need to. There's so many excuses. Oh, well, they have the flu. That's why they have a headache. Well, there's no set test. So the best thing to do is to rule conservatively, do this return to play protocol, and have an open line of communication between all parties. So the athletes feel comfortable and don't feel like they're letting their team down if they do say that they have a headache and have to be held out. Moms and dads need to tell the coaches or the athletic trainer or the healthcare professional that they do have a headache. So happy to help if needed. I think our information is on the website, but thank you.
All right. It's been a pleasure having you here. So my thanks today to Lynn Young of Orthopedic Physicians Anchorage and the Alaska School Activities Association for taking the time to help us understand these new recommendations and what we need to know about concussions. You can continue this conversation, if you like, on KSKA on the Facebook link at that alaskapublic.org. If you tune in next week, October 22nd, we're going to surprise you with a tag team host where Prentice Pemberton is a good friend of mine, and we're going to be discussing the relationship between parenting and childhood mental health with psychologist Dr. Ebony McLean Owens. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.